I would also like to add my very warm welcome to all of you, many familiar faces and some new. Can I just check, is anybody quite new to London Insight or to practice? Okay, all right, good, thank you. I'm a great supporter of London Insight and all of the places I teach at where we have non-residential retreats. I think it's quite one thing to go away somewhere like Gaia House for a week or longer and have a very enclosed, a very cloistered retreat space in a way. But I think there's something quite invaluable in doing retreats like this, where the proximity to your life is that much closer. So many times we have this very big gap between, you know, our meditative life and what often people refer to as their real life. And I think it is always a challenge for many people who are walking on this path to make that gap and that separation far less, far more transparent. And so there's something here about just stepping out of your life and stepping into a situation like this. And perhaps acknowledging that a meditative space is not just geographical. That cultivating a meditative space has much to do with our sense of intentionality, our attitudinal sense, our aspirations, our commitments. The Buddha, of course, never just taught formal meditation. In fact, formal meditation just is one slice of the teaching. It was far more concerned with teaching the way to live a more awakened life. That a life that includes everything, our relationships, our work, the moment-to-moment details that we all have to engage in our lives. How do we approach all of this? With the intention to understand, with kindness, to see more clearly, to have a refuge within ourselves. What I see over and over again in teaching is that, you know, people can go to the most secluded, most cloistered environments in the world. And yet, if they don't have a kind of inner setting of intentionality, that geography alone does not guarantee a kind of inner wakefulness. You know, you could go on a one-week silent retreat and spend the entire time in fantasy or, you know, rehearsing the future. That there is a way in which we learn to cultivate a meditative space. And, you know, when we come here, you know, you stepped out of your homes this morning, you know, step back into your homes this evening. You know, I'm sure many of you have complexities in your life, pressures, many responsibilities, many demands. And I think as we step into this space, it's almost discovering that we can choose what we do with our attention. That we could spend the entire day, you know, bound up in those complexities, rehearsing the future, dwelling on what's gone by. Or we could really perhaps explore the choice we have to establish ourselves in the present, to establish ourselves in this moment, to cultivate a refuge within ourselves, to commit ourselves to a quality of inner listening, listening to the life of our body, listening to the life of our mind. And that there's a kind of an emotional, psychological reorientation that I think is asked for us when we undertake a retreat of any length. And today we, and tomorrow actually, we have some very dedicated spaces. And what I would like to dedicate these 2 days to is to exploring two of what are called the Brahma Viharas, the divine abidings of boundless kindness, boundless compassion, boundless joy, and boundless equanimity. These are very central in the Buddhist teaching of awakening. In many ways, these qualities, I think, describe the deepest potential we have as human beings for emotional and for psychological freedom. They're described as immeasurable, as the world of living beings, embracing all beings, all events, all experiences in kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. This weekend, because we do have limited time, I'm just going to look at kindness and compassion. Brahma Viharas, these are called Brahma Viharas from the Pali Sanskrit. Brahma refers to noble, to awakened. Viharas refers to a monastery, an abode, the place where we make our home inwardly. They're not places we necessarily periodically visit and then forget. They are cultivations, they are pathways. As the Buddha put it, whether standing or sitting or walking or lying down, let us establish well this mindfulness, this abiding in kindness, this abiding in compassion. Now, some of you who are more familiar with the Buddhist teaching will perhaps recognize that over the centuries, something kind of curious has happened to these pathways of kindness and compassion and joy and equanimity. They're often seen as being the somewhat poor cousins of insight practice. They're the side dish, whereas insight practice is a kind of main course. Yet, in looking more closely at the early teachings of the Buddha, I think there's quite an emerging view in the way that the Buddha describes these qualities and the cultivation of these qualities as complete pathways of awakening in themselves. Not as something secondary, but as pathways that hold all of the elements of liberation and awakening. And to look at some of the dimensions of kindness and compassion. First of all, as qualities, they are truly said to be the foundation of an ethical life. That all ethical acts, words, thoughts of integrity are rooted in kindness and in compassion. They're trainings in intention as pathways. These are trainings in intention, learning to incline our hearts, learning to incline our minds to meet the world of people, of events and experiences with kindness and compassion. I think that Buddha saw very much probably as we see in our own lives and certainly looking at the world around us, the pervasiveness of greed, hatred and delusion. And the way that these patterns of confusion create so much sorrow, universally, socially, in families, in our relationships with others, and in relationship to ourselves. And we hear the words greed, hatred, and delusion. They feel like very big words, you know. Probably you wouldn't sit here this morning and say, well, you know, I'm just saturated with greed, hatred, and delusion. You know, they sound very dramatic. But actually, they're not that dramatic. They actually just are particular ways of seeing the world through certain lens. And a friend of mine recently I was teaching with, he said, I don't have to go anywhere else to see greed, hatred, and delusion. I just need to close my eyes. They're not necessarily big words, but as the Buddha suggested, that as long as we live in our lives, being compelled by wanting, by disliking, by not knowing what's going on, that we will actually find ourselves again and again in situations of struggle, of torment, of alienation, of estrangement. And as the Buddha suggested, there is a way of healing these patterns. There is a way of understanding them. There is a way of liberating them. And one of the very direct ways is to discover that we can indeed incline our hearts towards kindness, towards compassion. We can learn to allow them, to bring them into being in a way in which they guide our thoughts, our words, our actions. And in doing so, we actually see for ourselves the levels of torment and struggle in our lives begin to fall away. This would not be news to many of you. As we practice, as we learn to cultivate a greater mindfulness, a greater awareness of the life of our own heart and mind, as we begin to see moment to moment that the times when we are lost in aversion and resistance, in pushing away, in rejection, in judgment, these are moments almost instantaneously of suffering. We also begin to see more immediately in our lives when we feel that capacity to be more established in kindness and compassion, in understanding, we actually begin to see in our lives the levels and degrees of torment and struggle beginning to soften and beginning to fall away. These qualities of kindness and compassion, they are not concerned solely with inner development. They are always relational qualities. Always relational qualities. They are concerned with how we speak, how we relate, how we act together with others. They're said to be the cause of peacemaking, the way of healing conflict and division, the ways of bringing unity into places of estrangement. Now, these qualities of kindness and compassion, these are something not separate from mindfulness. In fact, they are interwoven. They're not strangers to us. Personally, I always feel like one of the great genius of the Buddha was to actually build upon what we already know, what we have already encountered and glimpsed in our life. I'm sure that we have all known moments of genuine friendliness and kindness, either receiving it from others, or we have all known moments of very unhesitating kindness, friendliness, arising from ourselves. We've probably all known in our lives moments of genuine compassion, in times when we've been distressed or sorrowful or confused. To be touched by the compassion of another is a remarkable thing. I'm sure we've all known moments in ourselves of reaching out very instinctively to comfort, to support, to touch another person in distress with compassion. And yet it's probably also true that these moments can feel something like accidental encounters. We treasure them deeply. They touch us deeply. And yet it seems so easy that we can move from those moments that touch us so deeply into another familiar moment of forgetfulness or busyness or haste or judgment or aversion. And it can all feel rather accidental. What the Buddha very much suggested is that these qualities, this most precious way of being in the world, does not need to be an accident. That these are pathways we can cultivate as much as we might cultivate any other meditative pathway. Through mindfulness, through intention, through learning to incline our heart. It's a training. Kindness is a training. Compassion is a training. Where do we cultivate it? Well, it's probably obvious. We cultivate kindness, we cultivate compassion in all the moments of aversion we experience. In our moments of greatest estrangement, greatest reluctance to be present, we learn to cultivate kindness and compassion. These qualities of kindness and compassion, of boundless friendliness and compassion, they're not just something we feel. In reality, they're very much concerned with what we do, with how we live, with how we act, with how we respond. My sort of current mantra, I must say, is recognizing that in this life we are always practicing something. It doesn't matter whether we're standing or sitting or walking or still, whether we're speaking or whether we are silent, whether we are together or whether we are alone, in this life we are always practicing something. And it's a really good question to ask of ourselves, to really look and say, what am I practicing in this moment? And we see that sometimes what we feel to be very much unconsciously practicing are some of the kind of more impulsive, habitual patterns that we are all too familiar with. Have you noticed how we seem to quite unconsciously practice aversion or fantasy or obsession? It's not like we get up in the morning and think, oh, well, this is a fantastic day to obsess, you know, and I think I'll just have a really aversive day. And yet, you notice you can go out your door and it's just like one moment follows another. You know, the bus is late and I'm grumpy, the weather's terrible. You know, why am I doing this today? And I could be doing something else. I should go back to bed. You notice what we're practicing? It doesn't feel like practicing, does it? But we are living something. We are embodying something in every moment of our life. And I think the real question in this path is not only to be able to look and to see what is it that we're practicing, what is it that we're embodying, what is it that we're cultivating, but to be able to ask ourselves, is it intentional, is it conscious, is it mindful, or is it simply a kind of, you know, a kind of surge of habit? And then to recognize that cultivation is a conscious choice. And to make those conscious choices in our life, every time we make those conscious choices in our life, we are likely stepping out of the habitual. We are likely stepping out of the impulsive. And one thing we can be truly, I think, quite certain about in this life is that what we practice will grow. That what we practice will deepen. So this path that we engage in here really actually almost begins in that place of mindfulness. But there's an insight part in here too, because we ask ourselves, what we are practicing, what we are embodying in this life, what is its outcome? What is its outcome? You know, do we actually see that there are good outcomes from aversion and confusion, or do we actually see there's just more aversion and confusion? What are the outcomes of mindfulness? What are the outcomes of greater kindness and compassion in our life? And to just read you something a little bit that the Buddhists, it's a kind of the kind of formula that runs through all of the pathways of kindness, of compassion, and joy and equanimity. Buddha suggests a practitioner dwells, abides, pervading one direction, with a heart filled with kindness and compassion. Likewise, all the directions, below, above, pervading the entire world, everywhere and equally, with a heart filled with kindness and compassion, grown great, measureless, free from enmity, and free from distress. Sounds like a fairly big ask. And yet, I think it's always helpful to remember in this pathway that the size of the task is only ever equal to the size of the moment. We don't practice tomorrow's kindness. We don't practice tomorrow's compassion. We can only ever, ever transform, understand the very moment, the very mind moment, the very heart moment we are actually in. I think what we see in the pathways of kindness and compassion is the way in which they hold the entire path of awakening within them. There is ethics, integrity. There is samadhi, the domain of meditative collectedness, learning to focus, learning to gather our attention, and they are certainly concerned with insight. Because if we look at the primary concern of kindness in terms of insight, it becomes obvious its primary concern is to uproot aversion. If we look at the primary concern of compassion, it is to understand the ways in which we meet distress and suffering and pain in this life. What I want to do over this weekend is very much to explore kindness and compassion as insight practices, practices of liberation. It's important to understand that although I might speak about them separately, that all of the Brahma Viharas of kindness, compassion, joy, equanimity, they are of course obviously all interwoven. There's a quote from the Buddha where he says, kindness gives to equanimity its boundless nature. Compassion guards equanimity from falling into indifference. Equanimity gives selflessness to kindness, gives patience, courage, and fearlessness to compassion. So, today around kindness. It's a Pali word. The Pali word is metta. Metta. It's a word that has its roots in the verb to befriend. And it is a verb. When we speak about metta, we're not speaking about an emotional state. We're talking about a quality of relationship, of befriending. Now, many of you will have heard metta practices presented as going through the human domains of befriending ourselves, befriending a benefactor, a good friend, a neutral person, the difficult person. These are all very, very skillful means. They're very helpful means as a practice. But it's also good to recognize that that particular form of practicing metta came in, you know, quite a few hundred years after the Buddha's death. And actually, when you look more closely at the way that the Buddha talks about metta, he talks about it as the attitudinal foundation of a life of integrity, a life of freedom, and the attitudinal foundation of all meditative practice. So in this sense, metta is not just about the human domains. It's also about events and experience. How do you relate to the pain in your knee? How do you relate to the reality of the bus coming late or seeing a person, you know, angry on the street? how you relate to the events of your emotional, your psychological world, the obsessive thinking, the difficult emotions. We can see that almost it's almost hardwired into our being, isn't it, to turn away, to abandon, to forsake the difficult. And metta practice is about turning that out and learning and developing our capacity to stand near to all things, all events and experiences, with kindness, with care, and with mindfulness. I cannot stress this enough, because if metta practice is something that's going to move into our life, both as a practice and an attitude, it can't just be confined to these domains of benefactors and difficult people. It needs to include these moment-to-moment encounters that fill all of our lives, that can indeed be challenging, painful, difficult. How can I learn to stand near to include, to embrace, to befriend, to find kindness within, rather than the habitual reactions of aversion and fear? The Buddha put it around this quality of metta, to resolve upon this mindfulness. So he talks about mindfulness, about metta or boundless friendliness, as a quality of mindfulness. To resolve upon this mindfulness during all one's waking hours, may one remain mindful of this heart and this way of living that is best in this world. May one remain mindful of this way of living, this heart that is best in this world. So what I want to do today is to certainly to offer some practice of metta. I want to keep it quite simple. I'm not going to say, let's just have a whole day of metta. If you want to, that is wonderful. But I'll talk about how to alternate metta with insight practice. So before we begin for a sit, I'd suggest that we take just a couple of minutes to stand up and stretch. I'd like to take us through just a short guided meditation, but just to say a few words about that today. I will introduce the formal practice of metta, which uses just a few simple phrases. Now, these few simple phrases, they're not something to just repeat and recite like a mantra. In a way, you have to think about these phrases, about just sort of seeds or that you're just planting in your heart or planting in consciousness. And then you listen to the responses that come. So with the formal metta practice, we go through these domains, these different domains of relationship that are part of all of our lives. But of course, in metta practice, we encounter many of the same obstacles that we do in any other form of practice. We forget. We just forget where we are. That's one of the obstacles. There's always that quality in that moment of forgetfulness to be aware of how we respond to forgetfulness. Do we come in with the big stick of, you know, I blew it again, you know, I can't do this, it's too hard? Or do we come in with metta, with friendliness? Ah, forgot, got lost, begin again. The other thing that happens, of course, as we use metta practice and metta phrases as an object of attention, just as we would use any other object of attention, is that there are many moments when our attention is drawn elsewhere. It might be to a sound. It might be to a body sensation. It might be to a very pressing thought or image that has arisen in the mind. Again, here, in these moments, it's really important to be mindful of our response. Do we kind of try to drag ourselves back, you know, to our benefactor, may you be happy? Or do we actually look at this sensation in the body? Look at this thought that's arisen, or this sound. Is there a reaction? Is there a level of judgment, of pushing away? Or can we greet those moments with this practice, this process of befriending? Making room for, ah, how do I care for that sensation in the body? How do I attend to that sound that's drawn my attention, or that thought? The possibility of becoming lost, or the possibility of touching that moment with kindness, and then coming back to the phrases. If at all you find it just, you know, too many words, which hopefully we won't fill ourselves up with words, you know, you can always just come back to your breathing for some moments. Just be mindful of the body breathing. Just simplify, simplify. The one thing that we don't want to do with metta practice is to turn it into a practice of overdoing, you know, into a practice of busyness, a project. It's remembering we are cultivating an inclination of the heart, leaning the heart towards what is in this moment in a particular way, with kindness, with care, and with mindfulness.